This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. President Donald Trump continues to tweet messages claiming the U.S. is winning its stare down with China over tariffs and trade. After some thaws in the relationship earlier in his presidency, Trump and his administration have upped the rhetoric and put tariffs in place with the aim toward shifting the balance of trade more into the favor of the United States.
In return, China has done the same thing, though as yet consumers might not have felt a significant jolt here. But is that coming? That is one subject of discussion for our conversation with contributor Art Sear from Carthage College in Kenosha. He joins us in the studio. Welcome back to the program.
Well, Mitch, thank you for welcoming me back. Always a pleasure to be here.
Likewise. Pleasure to have you here. Let's start with this burgeoning trade war between the U.S. and China. How does the trade balance fit in with other aspects of the economy?
Well, it's important, but the global economy is clearly so vast compared to earlier periods in our history and in world history that the very limited tariffs that the president has imposed and the reciprocal tariffs and related barriers that not only the Chinese but other nations have erected have not yet greatly afflicted the role of trade. And as usual, it's complicated, but I believe in contrast to even a few decades ago, there's such a tremendous amount of investment in foreign countries, foreign investment, especially by firms directly or indirectly American in nature, including in mainland China, where the biggest producers are really foreign investors, not their indigenous industries, with only one or two exceptions, that it hasn't yet had a big impact. So we can all be grateful for that.
Well, and so is what's happening here that when tariffs go into effect, suppliers look to other countries for goods, or there are already just such a mishmash of importers and exporters around the world that China doesn't – it represents a lot, but it doesn't represent so much that it's had an outsized impact on consumers yet?
Yeah, I think your mishmash – point is quite insightful because it's enormously complicated and also unpredictable. We also are very good at adjusting to circumstances, unlike perhaps every other nation in the world, with only one or two exceptions. Farmers are a small population in the U.S. We are the biggest agricultural exporter as well as importer. Agriculture is a pressure point in the U.S. for retaliation. But our farmers are extremely good at hedging, and traditionally they're used to great fluctuations in the market, whatever's going on in Washington. They're also historically accustomed to rapid and important and unpredictable policy shifts in Washington in terms of subsidies and other aid. So my guess is the farmers will survive. It's tough. I'm a professor sitting comfortably on the sidelines. It's tough, but American farmers and other business people are also very tough and durable.
Well, so if the impact on consumers is not as great as it would have once been, what's the issue that President Trump is trying to address by slapping Chinese goods with new tariffs and vice versa that China is attempting to address by doing the same to American goods?
I've read in serious publications that he is very strongly committed to protectionism personally. It also dovetails perfectly with his political strategy, the people who were most committed to voting for the president in 2016 and again, and no matter what happens, poll evidence is clear that they tend to be strongly protectionist as well.
Does that only extend to the point where they start to see an impact on their pocketbook?
Well, we'll see, because China and other countries in the developing world are increasingly important suppliers of consumer goods, both durable and transitory, T-shirts, athletic shoes, refrigerators, televisions, important components of automobiles. That's a larger percentage of a working person's income than more prosperous parts of society. So his strongest constituency will be impacted first. I don't think that'll have any bearing at all on their support for him. More important, China is rightly notorious and really outside the boundaries of the law in terms of outrageous intellectual property theft, using threats to get corporations to come across with trade secrets they'd rather not share, especially in the high-tech area. And I believe the current tough trade negotiations with them may well lead the Chinese to engage in better and more civilized practices. I'm not exaggerating. In the future. So in that sense, I think there's some beneficial aspects to the administration's current approach.
You say that this is the trade war is unlikely to have any impact one way or another on the people who are the president's most avid supporters. So you would say
No, perhaps I wasn't clear. I think it has a great impact, relatively strong impact, on those who are most committed to the president, because lower income people are more likely to see a big percentage price increase in their income. Sorry, I wasn't clearer.
Oh, okay. So he is taking a political risk here.
Yes. Again, I'm very much an academic, observing, and it's good. It would be good to talk to some practicing politicians on the subject in both parties. But my guess is there's a hard core of Trump supporters that will stick with him, no matter what he does.
The symbolism is just as important.
Yeah, I don't want to sound too condescending, but his whole career, from my biased point of view, is the real guiding principle isn't make America great again, but there's one born every minute. And there's a strong dimension of that to him, obviously. I don't think his hard core is enough to give him a popular majority next time around. But he does have a strong base that is more likely to vote the tougher he acts.
You were talking about it'd be interesting to hear from some practicing politicians. And on the Democratic side, I think roughly three quarters of the practicing politicians are already running for president.
Sure, it seems that way.
where would you say trade is likely to show up as an issue when it comes to the 2020 election?
Well, things can change very quickly in a couple of years and a couple of months and a couple of hours in today's world. But I believe the president has outmaneuvered the left of the Democratic Party, in the sense that the Bernie Sanders people and many others who would like to emphasize protectionism will be basically singing with the president's choir. So they'll have to look elsewhere now. But the Democratic Party, until after World War II, the Republican Party, understandably, was the protectionist party. But the Democratic Party, for the last 30 years or so, has been much more protectionist overall than the Republican Party. President Clinton, a brilliant deal maker in Congress and elsewhere, got the NAFTA treaty through both houses, which was a shrewd move. But he had a larger proportion of Republican support than Democratic support in getting it through, very much like Lyndon Johnson with civil rights in the 60s, when he was vitally dependent on Republicans more than Southern Democrats, obviously.
But right, there's a certain amount of political whiplash that one gets from watching this. And it sounds like what you're saying is it's going to be difficult for Democrats, especially ones on the left, to outflank the president when it comes to trade protection.
Yeah, so my guess is trade won't be. I also think that this will fade relatively quickly. I believe President Trump is essentially making a political point, and as soon as he's in a position, perhaps rather soon, to announce Chinese concessions, he'll declare victory and move on, as he has in other areas.
All right. So if that's where trade will or won't show up as a campaign issue between now and 2020, what about immigration?
There again, I think the president has taken over a very popular issue. But on immigration as opposed to trade, it's a very good question. I'm kind of thinking out loud as we talk. On immigration as opposed to trade, there are significant differences between the two parties. In 2013, Senate Democrats and Republicans, Marco Rubio and John McCain on the Republican side, Charles Schumer on the Democratic side, they worked together and brought about the so-called Gang of Eight brought about a remarkably responsible reform bill, which passed the Senate. President Obama rightly praised it publicly more than once. It died in the Republican House. But I do think that provides a model for bipartisan cooperation that will help both parties. The voters are sick and tired of this diehard partisanship that unfortunately has come to characterize Washington and the nation.
It is significant that as we're having this conversation, it's May of 2019. President Trump was elected in the fall of 2016. And even before that point, he was talking about this idea of building a wall. And here we are, you know, 3 years later, and this is still an issue. Well, you know, what is the wall? What does the wall look like? And who pays for the wall?
Well, he left it alone for 2 years and then suddenly started spreading political fires everywhere for political reasons, because 2020 isn't mine, but both the president and congressional Republicans were inert on the subject. It's one reason why it's important to mention the so-called Gang of Eight 2013 initiative, which is an excellent example of good government, and the problem, of course, has gotten worse, not better, since then.
Another issue that often plays into how people vote, especially in terms of, you know, how their pocketbook has been or their wallet has been affected, is the price of gas. And the price of gas more recently has gone way up from the point it was 3, 4, 5, 6 months ago. And a lot of that, I gather, has to do with trade sanctions against Venezuela, which is in a state of political turmoil, and Iran as well. With an election looming and with gas prices up, is there extra incentive for the U.S. to find some kind of way forward to stabilizing the situation in Venezuela?
I don't think Venezuela or Iran or any other foreign country is that big a factor, unlike the OPEC literally stranglehold on gas and oil prices worldwide that the cartel was able to bring about in the 1970s and for a part of the 80s. The U.S. is now the an enormous and growing net exporter of finished gasoline and, I believe, oil products across the board. The fracking revolution has been crucial in this, and the U.S. government does not directly control the oil industry in any way, shape, or form. But the U.S. government can, I think, do all kinds of things, not just petroleum-related, to help lower the price of oil and gas. Gas prices have been going up, but they haven't been going up all that much, and we're still a long way from $4 a gallon gasoline. And in real terms, from the enormously high prices, the skyrocketing that started in '73.
So unlikely
the short
to see
answer
gas
is no,
lines.
It's not related to Venezuela or the mullahs in Iran or anything else. And disciplined presidential policy can have a big impact. All roads seem to lead to Eisenhower now, and not just from my point of view, but in the 50s, he provided a classic textbook example of how to indirectly manage production in the U.S. as a way of compensating for the instability that resulted from the 56 Suez Crisis. So a serious and strong executive president can do a lot.
That is a to-be-continued moment for
absolutely.
Us.
Absolutely. No, but it'll continue. Absolutely. Oil and, to some extent, other resources will continue to be a major factor in our foreign policy.
Art Sear, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business, and he directs the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He is also our regular foreign policy contributor.